there. This is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Sunil Iyengar, who is the director of the Office of Research and Analysis at the National Endowment for the Arts. We're down here in his offices, here inside the Beltway, that den of thieves and iniquity. No, I didn't really say that, but where everyone plays liar's poker.
Right.
Sunil, welcome.
Well, couldn't ask for a more gracious introduction, Mark.
Indeed.
To be with you.
And Sunil, you run the office here, and you're a successor to a few people who've been in this job. I was in this job many years ago myself, and one of the important things you do is to monitor in some way the general participation of the American public in art forms of different kinds and venues. And the main instrument for that is the SPPA, the Survey of Public Participation in the Arts. So tell us about the SPPA.
Sure. And just before I do, I mean, just to reemphasize what you said, the reason we do this is because we want to sort of take the pulse of how Americans across the country from all kinds of backgrounds engage in the arts in different ways. And we want to understand the ways in which they engage as a way of understanding how we can serve them better through our grant making and through other initiatives, among other things. So, yes, the Survey of Public Participation in the Arts is, or the SPPA, as will be known from now on, is a survey we conduct as part of, really, with a great partnership in, it is one of the better partnerships, I think, that you can find within federal government with small agency like ours teaming up with the U.S. Census Bureau to do, and we've done this since 1982, a series of surveys about how American adults participate in the arts. So back in 1982, I think the questions were largely about attending certain types of arts events. And, you know, we've tried
so a typical question would be, and one of the older questions would be,
so did you go to a symphony or orchestra performance in the last 12 months? Did you go to a art museum or gallery in the last 12 months? And we still have those sort of, you call them legacy questions now in the survey. So we still are able to track what the ratio is or what the rate is of participation relative to those previous years. So that gives us a really interesting tool to look at trends, long-term trends.
And so the museum world, the art world, the organizations that represent those institutions, they're very interested in what
I would
what
hope so. Yeah, they have over the years expressed an interest, and even some sectors or some segments of the arts and cultural industries have used it to sort of redirect and think about how they approach audience development, how they approach marketing, but also how they approach, you know, providing services. Most of these are nonprofit arts organizations that do this work in this country that the NEA funds. And so they're interested in reaching underserved audiences through this work. Mm-hmm. So the survey, we hope, will help them in that sense as well, like a diagnostic.
Because you break it down by age. I mean, it's a population survey.
Right.
The Census Bureau, gold standard, you have a large sample of 15 to 20,000. Who fill this out? You break it down by age, and so you can look at something like the graying phenomenon, which is what?
Well, so this is one of the first things that the survey got in the national media is this concept of the graying of arts audiences. This is back in the mid-80s when, because of the survey data, there was recognition that you saw older and older adults proportionally attending more of these kinds of arts events that I've just named, for example, versus other generations. And so there was a concern.
Losing the younger audience.
Losing the younger audience was, I think, part of the anxiety that I think we were all confronted with. But I think over time, I have to say, you see some surprises as the years unfold. You find that age is actually not as significant a predictor of whether someone is likely to participate in the arts. Where it really comes down to is, it would seem to make sense, right? Education level, particularly arts education. If you were exposed to the arts as a child, if you engaged intensively with the arts through classrooms in K-12, you are much more likely to engage not only as an audience member, but actually as a creator of your own or as a, you know, in any number of ways to engage with the arts.
Well, I mean, I was exposed, in the 60s to the arts because I watched Bugs Bunny.
Well, you know, so you say that tongue-in-cheek probably, but so we do
actually— a lot of classical music there in those cartoons.
You can take it up a notch and talk about Fantasia, right, or something
right,
like that.
Right, right,
the broom and Mickey Mouse.
I think I heard
It was an opera, right?
They did a few famous opera. They were doing Wagner in one of the— what's opera, Doc? I think that was the episode. I remember hearing the do 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 do, and I had this vision of Bugs Bunny who has, or some cartoon character who had taken some nitrous oxide, and he was kind of floating above the grasses, you know, up there in the air.
It was the 60s. So there you go.
There you go. I thought, Bugs Bunny, you know, or cartoons. I remember that. Or things like, you know, the Leonard Bernstein's famous young people's concerts that were televised, and they were hugely popular.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things we're very interested in is how does a mass audience or mass, you know, the general population, and here we're talking about people from all kinds of demographic, socioeconomic groups, how do they rally around an arts event in terms of engaging with it? And I think we are starting to see some interesting connections, such as, you know, we're now in an age, of course, where maybe you know this, like roughly 70% of adults have done some kind of arts activity on media. Now, you might ask, what do you mean by an arts event? Well, it could be posting something on YouTube. It could be, Instagram poetry. It could be actually watching a broadcast video or a video of an arts event. If you look at that percentage, that tells you something, because, you know, most of these surveys, you know, over the years, we've seen maybe about 30%, 35% of adults doing certain types of attendance activities, arts attendance activities. Mm-hmm. So obviously there's a larger share, if you think about it, who are going online to do art. So I think arts organizations have been increasingly interested in that connection. Like, how can you reinforce arts participation in all its variety, you know, for all groups, and yet retain, you know, an understanding that there's some experiences that are best had in a sort of attendance format, or that are had over media, or that are had through creating an art or engaging, you know, where the artist works with the audience, you know, some like festivals, for example. Performing arts festivals are a great example of going to something and getting a smorgasbord of arts experiences. You can, you know, it's very rich texturally. You have a lot of opportunities to participate in different art formats. And yet we find that the general population is much more likely to go to those kinds of events than necessarily going to a particular type of arts event. So we've really looked lately at performing arts festivals, especially outdoor festivals, as a great portal to participating in the arts.
Does the Arts Endowment look at some of the findings and actually try to incorporate those trends into some of its grant making?
Yeah, so the grant making here is all kind of, if you want to look at our statute, it's very much focused on artistic excellence and artistic merit. So our grants have that criteria always first and foremost, and they are adjudicated by a panel. All of these things are paneled in the sense that we bring together experts from around the country, but we also bring together citizens from all backgrounds. So we really do have a very a pool of reviewers, which really represents the U.S. population, but also is going to look at this strictly for artistic excellence and merit. So what I'm trying to get at here is it's not so easy to prescribe a national policy through grant making, and we don't really strive to do that, I think. But some of our, what you might call our national initiatives, are very much in doing the work that our surveys are kind of calling needs to be done. So the Big Read is a great example of that, where communities all around the country are increasing literacy and reading through community reading programs and looking at great books, you know, from contemporary and older books that are, you know, in a way, and having dialogues with these books in a way that would speak to what our survey is getting at, which is, for example, a decline in reading literature. So we're hopeful that programs like that, like Poetry Out Loud,
Poetry Out Loud is still going. in high schools all over the country. What was Poetry Out Loud?
So Poetry Out Loud, I believe, began in 2006, and it was a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation. It's essentially, imagine a spelling bee with more of a sporting event feel to it. Mm-hmm. It's a recitation contest of poetry.
Poetry recitation contest. Yes. The kids get up.
Yeah, they get up. So it's
recite.
Exactly. They get up, they recite poems, and they do it with flair, and they do it with a fidelity to the words on the page. Mm-hmm. But they do it with often in a way that really is captivating and gets across the best of the poem to the viewer, and it becomes a really
It's a competition.
Judged. Absolutely, they're judged, and it goes. It's like a triangle kind of format. It goes from the schools to the states. Then the states go to the national level.
There's like the National Spelling Bee. Yes. There's a National Poetry Out Loud.
Absolutely. And the state arts agencies and state, I should call them out, all the states have one, and the territories have these agencies, which are U.S. territories, which also support this program. And so because of their help, this goes all the way through to the national level. The national finals are held here in D.C.
Well, I attended the national finals 1 year. It might have been 08 or 09. And you had an audience there. I think it was at the Folger. Might have been at the Folger Library. And the kids would come up, high school students would come up, and they would recite poems. And these were mostly classic poems, John Donne or Ezra Pound. And because it was a competition, the intensity in the room was high. Oh, and a student would finish, there'd be cheering, it was rock. It was like a sporting event with poetry at the center.
I think what you've put your finger on too is something that we believe is sort of an irreplaceable part of understanding, how the arts matter and why do they matter. Because you find that so many kids react and respond to the arts in their lives in a way that helps them learn in other disciplines. I'm not saying it's like the Mozart effect or there's, music that once you listen to great music, you're immediately going to be great at math or something like that. Mm-hmm. But there is definitely an student engagement that a lot of educators have pointed to and said the arts did this for the student who would have known, that somebody would be interested in poetry when they maybe don't take as much of an interest in certain other academic disciplines.
Well, just think about it. To compete, one, You got to use your mind and memorize.
Yeah.
Memorization, and that means absorbing the language. And what does that do? Just in terms of abstract skills, you're building your vocabulary. You're improving, obviously, your oratorical skills. You can speak in front of a group of people. And one thing not to be underestimated is, you're 17 years old, you're narcissistic, you're absorbed in yourself and what's going on in your life because you're an adolescent.
Yeah.
You have to get out of yourself and get into the mindset, the character of that poetry, of that speaker in that poem. You have to act, but you have to follow the lead of a great poet. These are all wonderful things to happen to a 17-year-old.
It's great modeling. And I have to say, just if I could just point out, I'm talking about some of our national initiatives. Another one that I really think would be remiss not to mention is a program called Our Town, which is very much about community development through the arts. And at first, it sounds very abstract, but what you're finding is
it was a play by Thornton Wilder.
Yes, it was, exactly.
Almost a century ago.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that allusion, too. But what's nice about this, and I refer back to our survey, we found in the survey this time, we were kind of surprised, a lot of the growth in arts attendance we're seeing is driven what you might call informal spaces, like people going to, mentioned festivals, going to outdoor performing festivals. But in fact, also going to historic sites and designs, places of great design and architecture. Mm-hmm. And the NEA also has a program called Mayor's City Institute of Design, which works on empowering, lawmakers and local municipalities to develop their communities in a way that's attentive to beauty, to aesthetics, but also is going to provide economic development and stability for those communities. And so created what this phenomenon called creative art, creative placemaking, which is really epitomized by Our Town, that program, is really the NEA's way of kind of helping to support community development through the arts. And mm-hmm. so this will involve cultural tourism. It involves local economic development that we're also seeing in our survey, again, is maybe a draw for a lot of people to go to these places of, you know, to cultural districts historic sites that have some arts component.
Here's what's interesting. It is those cities and towns that some of them fell into steep decline in the mid-20th century, and so they didn't undergo urban renewal. And then they somehow had a revival, and they had all this great old architecture that was preserved, like Savannah is a typical story. Right. Savannah in 1965, downtown Savannah was a bad place. Right. Now you go there, these beautiful old antebellum homes, people come there and tour these homes. Midnight in the Garden of Evil, you know, that book did a lot for it. SCAD, this is Savannah College of Art and Design. And people love going there. Georgetown, you know, right here. Yeah. Georgetown in 1960 was kind of a marginal place in a lot of ways. Now, of course, you know, the old townhouses and the little streets, all the historic value, it draws people. People like cultural depth in local situations.
And you know, there's obviously, you know, smart mayors take advantage of that for, you know, economic development purposes, as I mentioned, but it's also a great narrative for that community and gives a sense of identity and cohesion. Mm-hmm. In fact, Mark, you probably remember when you were here, I think you were noticed that in our survey data, there's an interesting correlation between people attending arts events and volunteering in their communities and mm-hmm. doing social good, you know. And I think what we're finding is we're examining the relationship between arts participation and social cohesion. And, you know, the idea that in place-based arts projects, there's often a great deal of social cohesion that can then benefit local health, local crime rates, you know, so forth, and help to provide a more vital community.
Now the last SPPA came out when?
So the survey was done in 2017, but it does take a while to process the data and analyze it. So we just released early September, I believe, the results of the attendance and reading questions in the survey.
Big news?
Yeah, there's some big news. For us, what's interesting is that by and large, it's good news that we've seen attendance rates for visual arts and performing arts events go up.
So that means art museums?
Yes, art museums, galleries. I mentioned some of these historic sites and design places.
Do film festivals count?
Film festivals, right now we don't have a question specific to film festivals. We did have it in a previous survey. It was just a small, very small fraction of the general population. You have to remember it's really asking American households around the country, did they go? And we have a limited amount of questions we can ask. So we do ask if people went to the movies, and that's remained about stable, more than 50%, obviously, went to the movies in the last year.
So museum attendance is a visual?
It's a visual arts event that we count. Theater actually held stable. So let me just talk about performing arts for a second. Yeah. We did ask about performing arts in a variety of ways. What we found is that the real there was an increase there in that category. But the driver was really, as I said, attending performing arts festivals and attending what's called nondescript arts events. What we mean by that is we can't ask about every single event under the sun, or we'd be there with the interviewer forever.
Right.
So what we do is we ask about certain questions like classical music attendance, jazz, opera, ballet, theater that we've been asking since the 80s.
Right.
But then we ask a new question, which is there anything I mentioned that you didn't Is there any other kind of performing arts event you went to? And we suspect that's like country music, rock,
folk
hip-hop.
Music,
So that category went up. We don't know exactly what's driving that, but we also think that's often held in much more informal venues than some of the other types of arts events we're asking about.
So is classical music was
classical music was stable.
And the preceding one was 2008?
2012. And this is important, though, and I keep trying to make this point, is that for many of the other art forms, we really didn't see any declines across these art forms. Mm-hmm. Where we saw the other ones were just holding steady, and that's actually a considerable feat, because that means that despite the increase in the population, because this is a percentage of the U.S. adult population that attended this.
So the absolute numbers are going up.
Yeah, the absolute numbers are going up in most cases, and we believe that the reason that really that's a good thing because and it also tracks with what we know of the economy. So mm-hmm. if you think about 2012, that was still kind of in the shadow of the recovery period of the recession. Mm-hmm. 2008 is when we saw a big dip, and that was mm-hmm. right in the middle of the 2007 to 2009 recession. Mm-hmm. 2012, we saw some slow recovery, and now we're seeing a decisive recovery. We're seeing some increases and stability in these art forms.
Where is classical music in 2018 relative to the 2002?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's still lower than the 2002 level. Okay. And so you can't entirely say that the economic recession was responsible for people going to fewer concerts yeah. because they don't have enough money or something. There may be something more complicated going on. We don't
jazz?
Know.
Jazz?
Jazz also, I believe.
Long-term trend for jazz?
The bottom line is for every single art form that we've been tracking since 82, they're still below the 2002.
So a long-term slight yeah. decline, but short-term increase.
Yes, short-term
increase in those.
And, yeah, exactly.
And let's get to the reading issue. Yeah. You said the reading issue. That's the one area that has some bad news.
Well, it has bad news, and it has a dose of really good news for people who love poetry. So, yeah. Just to give you tell listeners what we're talking about here. We ask people if over the last 12 months if they've done the following: Have you read a book of any type?
Any
could be
type.
Online could be. You don't have
any,
to finish
any
the
format.
Whole book. Right, any format in the last 12 months. We also ask people: Did you read a novel or short story? Did you read a poem or did you read a play? And so those are basically most of the questions about reading that we ask people. So reading books actually held statistically, the change wasn't statistically significant. It was about steady from last time.
Okay.
But when you ask about novels and short stories, you saw a decline, which is troublesome because that's consistent with what's been going on in the long term. Very accentuated decline.
Literary reading in prose.
In right? prose, fiction specifically. So short stories or novels, we've seen a marked decline. And so it's actually below, I believe it's like 41% or something of adults having read a novel or short story in the last year.
I'm an English teacher, Sunil, and I'm that makes me very sad.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of us sad. I think though that, and so we'll get to that in a moment. But let me talk about poetry. Poetry we did find has been, it also was on a downward trajectory, if you will. And this year it seems to have gone up substantially. I mean, the
rate
nice change.
Bump.
Yeah, it's
yes.
about 76% of the rate has increased. So what we mean is that's a percentage of a percentage, and that means that 76% greater poetry readership in our numbers. And so we.
So what yeah. percentage of American adults did read a poem?
Yeah, it was about 12% of adults
okay.
read a poem. So that might seem like a huge percentage, but it's substantially greater than the 6% or whatever that read in 2012.
Right.
And so that's accounting for this increase. And when you look at this, though, when I look at demographic groups that did read poetry, what you find here is that you find substantial increases across all of these categories. And I will say a little bit surprising, I guess. You see Asian Americans, African Americans among the biggest readers of poetry. When you look at our numbers, you mm-hmm. find young adults, they doubled their poetry reading rate. They're mm-hmm. they grew the highest rate of all age demographics, 18 to 24 year olds, that is. So you see a lot of interesting things, and it is pretty much across the board. And so, it does beg the question, why is that?
Do you guys have any?
Well,
it's not your job to speculate,
it would be,
right?
Yeah, job is to look at the facts, but right. we do find these demographic groups engaging at a higher rate. And so we ask, well, what is going on here, young adults? We also know correlationally that young adults are the most likely to be reading on media or reading online or mm-hmm. using media to engage with the arts in general. There's been a lot of talk about Instagram poetry. I'm actually not okay. as familiar with it personally, but I know that there's been a lot of attention to social media.
You sure providing... Instagram poetry is an oxymoron?
Yeah, I'll leave others to
sure
decide that.
That. Okay.
But I do think the point is that the brevity, if you will, I don't know if it brings out the best of us in terms of expression, but mm-hmm. brevity or mm-hmm. concision is a virtue in that art form.
Poetry is more suited to that, to the iPhone.
Perhaps.
The iPhone screen.
There you go. But I don't want to be facetious about it. I also think what's going on is you could argue that through diverse media, you are also seeing people watch people reading poetry more. You're seeing people engage with poetry maybe through YouTube or recitations, hip-hop. Mm-hmm. You're seeing all kinds of ways people get into poetry, and that may be spilling over into their reading habits. Mm-hmm. So there is that. One could also just say, well, maybe people are teaching it better. I would like to think that programs like Poetry Out Loud and grassroots programs that have established a national following are playing their part too, and that you're seeing much more of a comfort level with poetry than you and I might have had by our, you know, depending if you had a good English teacher or not.
You know, I wonder if a lot of, especially younger respondents, would say that when they go on YouTube and they might listen to a hip-hop song and the lyrics appear on the screen, that's poetry. That's a poetry reading.
You don't know.
On their part.
Well, if they're reading the lyrics.
If they're interested in the lyrics sort of an independent expression.
Right. So this is a kind of a meta question, is that I feel a lot of the survey questions about, you know, they don't really name the arts. They ask about a specific format.
Right.
But in a way, you wonder, does it change people? Are people's perceptions of poetry changing more than the actual, what we would consider reading?
Right,
who knows?
Right.
But for whatever reason, there's an affinity in the people who responded yes to that question. Much more than there was in the past.
Yeah.
So I do agree with you. It could be any of number of those things. But you know, there has been media reports that 2017 was a really good year for poetry book sales. Seems a little anomalous taken on its own. But when you look at our findings, perhaps then there was indeed more. And some of that was driven by what I've called Instagram poetry.
Now, in the survey, do you distinguish between leisure and work and school?
Yes, a good point. Yeah. So, yes, these are things that should have been read, that we add. The way we ask the question is not counting for work or school. Did you read any?
Okay,
blah,
so
blah,
this
blah.
Is just voluntary leisure for pleasure.
Yeah.
Reading for pleasure, interest.
The frame of the question is like that. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And then, in fact, all these art forms that I've mentioned, they're all, when we ask, did you do this, did you do that, it's all not related to school. So it's not that they went to a high school. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, that's art participation, but we're not so much counting if they went to a high school performance of Pippin or something versus did they go to a non-school-based performance or museum exhibit.
Okay. And... Anything about the decline of novels and short stories that
I don't really like the term, but I think long form, I think is how people refer to it, long form reading.
Yeah.
And the only reason I don't like it because it's so relative, like what's long form. But there is a sense that long form reading, let's just say the antithesis of Instagram, is you could argue that's been, there are other indicators that that's not taken as seriously anymore, or let's say it's not a leisure habit or a non-work related habit or a non-school related habit as much as it was in the past.
And this is you know, a 20-year pattern.
Yeah, I mean,
with the rise of the digital, you know, media, visual, the more things going more and more visual.
There's a lot of couple interesting things. Will Self wrote an essay in Harper's about this. I think it was in Harper's. There's Marianne Wolfe, who studies neuroscience and reading at Tufts University, has come out with a book on the format of reading and what an electronic age has done. And this isn't hand-wringing. I really don't believe it's an era of hand-wringing. I think it's we're really just saying there are other trends out there that no question have had an impact on the way people engage with these traditional forms.
Right.
The NEA, I have to say, you know, in addition to trying to provide access to all Americans to arts, and to providing opportunities to engage with the arts through arts education, through performances, through exhibits, through all that, through creative placemaking. In addition to that, we're interested in upholding cultural traditions and maintaining, you know, folk and traditional arts. Old, you know, Jazz Masters is a great program. Mm-hmm. So we really want to make sure that younger generations have access to these art forms and formats. And so there's a custodial role in an agency like the National Endowment for the Arts too. So we hope that, you know, the survey helps to elevate the need to stay engaged with these art forms.
Right. I mean, I come at this as a teacher. I have to say that if I look at the profile of students, and I'm at Emory University, pretty selective institution, smart kids, ambitious kids, but there is a profile that has to some degree disappeared. And that is the bookish student. The student, you know, when I started teaching in the 80s, you know, at UCLA, you would get these kids in class that were maybe a little offbeat. They weren't so conscious of grades, but books really mattered to them. And so if you just mentioned a book that was not on the syllabus, just referred to it, that student might come in and just drop by your office a week later having dipped into it and wanted to come talk about it. You don't find that kind of independently interested in books, in reading, and books really mean something to that student. And I think that probably the pressures are, apart from the digitization of everything, maybe the achievement model. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have time to pursue an intellectual bookish life when you're 20 because you've got your coursework. And you the grades and the competition, and if you're competing for jobs and graduate school positions, then taking the time to read War and Peace just seems impossible.
So there's so many responses I have to that. One is quickly just to mention there's a program, it's run out of Georgetown, which unites arts and medicine, or specifically literature and medicine. Mm-hmm. And it gives sort of training, residents and training, medical doctors, you know, a curriculum like to read great, wonderful literature, contemporary novels. Mm-hmm. And they have discussions about it, and they found that it's therapeutic for these physicians in terms of reducing burnout rates.
Hmm.
And it's been adopted very successfully. There's a column in The Lancet, you know, which is a very famous medical journal. I think it's a monthly column on literature and medicine because of this connection.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was very interesting. But I guess the broader point I'm trying to make is that, you know, there is what you say. I think we often advertise, and I mean people who provide arts and cultural services through funding, advertise, and we should, you know, the economic benefits, the benefits for academic, you know, knowledge retention, all kinds of demonstrated benefits of the arts. But one of the things that's harder to quantify or show is that it creates a space and time for reflection and for
just stepping out
of yourself. And that's something which psychologists have actually looked at. But in terms of giving it an instrumental value, like, oh, you're going to get rich that way, or you're going to, you know, this is going to improve your performance on this or that test. Mm-hmm. It's harder to show that, nor do we necessarily want to show that. But we do think it's important for there to be a space apart to take reflection, and the arts have a wonderful way of doing that, pressing pause for a moment.
I tell my students, look, you should all have a book you're reading at your bed. The last 20 minutes of the day, everything's off. It's quiet. The phone is off, the screen, the TV. And it's you and that book you're reading. And it's a reprieve, it's an escape, it's a plunge into another world. And it takes you out of the hustle of homework and racing around and part-time jobs and the social life in particular. And that this can be something to look forward to.
Right? Yeah.
This can be something that you savor all by yourself.
Yeah, and I think C.S. Lewis, I think, said about reading, you know, it's and I'm going to quote it wrong, but it's something like, you know, this is the only way I can be 1,000 people and still be myself. When you're reading something, you're experiencing so many different worlds. And, you know, the true empathy is really occurring, and that's been studied in research. That's another story. But at the same time, you're yourself, and you step out of yourself, but you feel more affirmed about your own identity too.
Right, right. And the next SPPA will be?
So the Survey of Public Participation in the Arts, the next one will be in 2021. So,
2021. So you're preparing already?
Eventually we will, yes. Right now we're still doing some follow-up research. I mean, there's a lot of data in here that I haven't even touched, and we actually need more work on to understand. You know, we talked about this decline in reading, but there's a lot of ways to view that. I mean, you can look that through demographics. You can understand, well, do these people like doing anything else in our survey? The people who don't read, maybe they like to do other kinds of things. And,
mm-hmm.
and this is a way of us understanding how they can be engaged more effectively by people who care about literature, but also how they, you know, to serve them better. But also, you know, to elucidate some of the connections between reading and other types of activities, like social civic engagement. And we also have studies on media arts. That's a huge area of work that we haven't even talked about, really.
How do you catch up with all of the digital innovations?
It's impossible. I mean,
it's impossible.
The survey is a very crude instrument to catch up with all that, but it does give you some indicators. And so, we are trying to understand the correlations between engaging with the arts electronically and live through attendance. I know I've probably used those terms wrongly, because you could say a performance, an HD stream of an opera is just as good as a live performance, perhaps.
Right.
But my point is, we're trying to understand how these various art forms relate to each other when it comes to engagement digitally. And also, even understanding differences between urban and rural communities. And does it give communities an opportunity to engage with the arts that they would not have? We suspect it's true,
mm-hmm.
but what did the survey data show us about people taking advantage of those opportunities?
Yeah. One thing I was wondering, that you did the survey in 2017,
yeah.
and you're asking about the previous year.
Yeah.
I would have thought that the reading of political and civic books would have gone up, given the election.
Well, we don't know that. That's a great question. We don't actually have this was the first time we asked a question about political type books, and we haven't in the past.
You did.
Before. So, let me go through the questions. Actually, I apologize. It was biography and history and religious texts. So actually 23% of adults said they read a religious text in the last year.
Now, you couldn't say the Bible, right? Had to be very generic
because of the survey,
government
right.
issues.
I mean, we were definitely talking about any kind of religious text.
Right.
History.
So 23% read a religious text in the preceding 12 months.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
22% read a work of history. Could have been a political history.
Right.
Same thing with biography. 20% read biography. Science and technology, we actually asked about, just to understand what the overlap is. It's about 13% of adults who read a work of science or technology. Hmm. And I don't have this data with me, but I do seem to recall there were some interesting gender splits that you don't see. Like a lot of arts participation, you tend to see women and young women participating at higher levels than men.
Mm-hmm.
But in some of these reading types, you saw men reading more in some categories. Graphic novels, it was actually about 7% of adults. So this is a question we often get, is people will say, well, you asked, did you read a novel, a short story? But what if it was a comic book novel or something? And so we just
want
to try it out. Yeah, so we're just trying to see what that is. It's about 7%. About 23% of people who said they engaged with a book did so electronically. 23%.
Okay. I have read that the e-book growth has pretty much stalled. It's steady. It's holding where it is, but the idea of the e-books really starting to overwhelm cloth and paper books, that no one's talking about that anymore.
No.
They were 10 years ago.
We're going to be looking into that a little bit with our – so the report we hope to produce, one of them, we're producing about 4 different reports on different aspects of the survey, because people are probably interested in why people do things. So we have questions about motivations and barriers for participating in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
We're interested in things like personal tastes. We're doing a report on preferences. But then we're also doing a report on media, and we're doing one on reading. And the one on reading is going to look at some of the things you said, look at this some of the other data sources that tell us, what do they tell us about electronic books?
Mm-hmm.
What does it tell us about publishing? What does it tell us about bookstores? And we're trying to produce hopefully a readable report that is going to yoke together these different strands, because I think people are very interested in, not this data point in isolation, but what's really happening with literature at this current moment in time.
Right. So
and by the way, 17. This is another thing that often gets a lot of press coverage, is audiobooks, right? So 17% of adults said they listened to a book. So I often wonder, does that include streaming? Does it include things like your podcast, where maybe parts of a book are read? We're going to try to get deeper into this.
Very good. Well, we're going to look forward to that.
Thank you.
I thank you for joining us today,
Sunil. Great to be here.
All right.
Mark.